You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a Wisconsin author about a new collection of short stories and the influence the state had on her writing. Now, the gun deer hunting season in Wisconsin gets underway on Saturday. Nearly 900,000 people were out across the state in tree stands and camouflage for last year's hunt, and the Department of Natural Resources estimates a strong deer population and a likely increased harvest this year. We're finding out more about what the gun deer season means to Wisconsin wildlife, culture, and economy. Jeff Pritzel is the Deer Program Specialist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Jeff, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob, it is good to be with you.
Well, a 9-day gun deer season. What is your outlook this time around?
Well, like I said in the introduction, I think, you know, the deer population numbers are trending on an upward trend. Our harvest to this point through the archery and crossbow seasons have been following that. Our buck harvest has been ahead of the 5-year average. So weather conditions, everything is pointing in the right direction, except for possibly the lack of snow on the ground this weekend, which we all hope for. But that's usually a treat. It doesn't happen in most years. So hunters will adapt, and opportunities are looking pretty good.
For non-hunters, can you talk about why hunters are hoping for at least a little bit of snow?
Sure. It just improves the sight picture a lot better as far as seeing movement, the deer moving against a white background in the cover. And it also helps with tracking in the snow, seeing tracks and recovering animals more efficiently. And I think some people just think it looks prettier too.
Can you talk a little bit about the role of deer hunting for Wisconsin's culture and economy?
Sure. Well, and I do. I think it's culturally, it's important. It's amazing that, you know, you said well over 500,000 people will be out this weekend doing something with a common interest. Although there's a whole variety of actual goals people are looking for and what they're hoping to get out of the hunt. Everything from the venison to perhaps a trophy that'll create memories that they'll put on the wall. And in some people, it's just to be communing with nature and with each other, with family in an environment, being outside. We saw a lot of increased activity last year as a way to cope with the pandemic. And I think we have people coming in from all walks of life with varying views, but next weekend, they're deer hunters. And so that's important. It just adds to the quality of life. From an economic standpoint, deer hunting collectively, you know, will contribute to about $1 billion worth of economic activity in this state. And so, you know, again, the fact that so many people will be doing this, you know, in one weekend or over the course of the week, but really this weekend is where everyone's going to be doing it. Right. There's nothing that rivals in the state that many people are doing something collectively.
I know regulations for the gun deer hunt can change, get tweaked from year to year. Anything that hunters should be paying special attention to this year when it comes to changed rules?
Sure. And well, one of the good news features is there aren't any significant changes. For the most part, it's like, you know, it was in 2020. Where we do see changes are on a county by county basis as it relates to either the baiting and feeding bans, prohibitions that are associated with presence of chronic wasting disease, and a few counties have been added to that role. There's only like 15 counties left in the state where baiting is permissible. And so checking the regulations to make sure the county you're hunting in is either open for baiting or not is important to be aware of that. And then also, not now for the 9-day gun season, but there'll be harvest opportunities later in the year in what we call our farmland zones, and counties have the option to participate in what we call the holiday hunt, which is another firearm season that's dedicated for antlerless deer only between Christmas and New Year's. And those that can turn on and off in a county. And so they need to check and be aware of whether that's happening. But again, that's for later, but something to keep in mind if they find out they didn't have much success during the 9-day.
Talking to Jeff Pritzel, Deer Program Specialist for the State DNR, looking at the upcoming gun deer season. Jeff, you mentioned CWD, chronic wasting disease. It's been a concern in the state since I started working at this network X number of years ago. What are you watching for now when it comes to CWD?
So there's two things that we're in a position right now to monitor and keep track of where the disease is in the state and where it isn't. And so that's in terms of its presence and monitoring the rate of spread, because we have a goal of trying to reduce that or limit that rate of spread. And there's recommendations about how to do that. And then the other aspect of it is the prevalence of the disease in those core areas where it's been around for a long time. And so the percent of animals that are carrying or are positive with this disease. And we accomplished that through the voluntary assistance of the hunters providing those samples when they harvest a deer by donating the head of the deer, where we can get the sample, you know, required. And those opportunities are throughout the state through self-service kiosks. And we have those locations on our website so that hunters can help us track the disease as far as where it is and where it isn't.
There are a lot of different rules and guidelines for hunter safety and hiker safety when people are out hunting. Can you hit a couple of key points for us when it comes to making this season as safe as possible?
Sure. Well, the requirement to wear blaze orange clothing for the hunters, or blaze orange or pink is the case now, but mostly everyone is using orange, from a visibility standpoint is key and paramount, has really added to the safety aspect, along with the mandatory hunter safety and hunter and education to practice safe firearm handling. And we have seen a really nice, I can't even call it a trend anymore, because really for the last 10, 20 years, we've had really a safe track record, but to where we can really focus on just one or two incidents are one or too many. And we're trying to eliminate all of those. But as it relates to overlapping deer hunting with other activities outside, it is not as mutually exclusive, I think, as some people may perceive. There's other activities that can go on through hunters and their training of where they can hunt, where they can discharge their firearms. You know, it's set up to minimize any risks, but there are special rules in place for designated trails, for example, especially on public lands where hunters have to remain. They can utilize the trails to access their locations, but they cannot hunt from those trails. They have to be at least 50 feet off the trail. And in some cases, like for example, the Ice Age Trail, it's even further. They have to be 100 yards from the trail, and they cannot hunt again from the trail or discharge a firearm toward or across a trail, and treating it basically just like a public road.
And Jeff, before I let you go, if people have questions, what kind of DNR resources would you point them toward?
Well, we've got a robust amount of information on our website. If you search deer, or even certain aspects of deer, our search engine will do really well to get you in the direction of what's out there. We have a deer metrics system for people that want to get into the numbers of what's going on. And if they search for deer metrics system, that'll take us, and you can go county by county and really dive into what's going on and what the history has been on those the deer herd in those areas. And then we also have a phone app for the hunters, but others could utilize it too, called Hunt Wild Wisconsin. It's free, and it has a lot of features that just make access to the regulations and access to navigation and even tracking harvest, registering your deer. It's all right there. We try to make it as convenient as possible.
Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet, Rob.
That's Jeff Pritzel, Deer Program Specialist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. We talked to him about the upcoming start of Wisconsin's gun deer hunting season. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a very good girl.
The Mequon Nature Preserve, north of Milwaukee, is home to Wisconsin's first conservation dog, Tilia. WPR's Mary Kate McCoy recently traveled there to learn how they're harnessing Tilia's powerful sense of smell to reach their conservation goals.
That sniffing you hear is Tilia, the conservation dog at Mequon Nature Preserve. Right now, she's looking for a treat. But when she's on the job, she'll be sniffing out wild parsnip or salamanders.
There you go. Good girl.
What exactly is a conservation dog, you might ask? Tilia's main job is to detect both invasive and endangered species at the nature preserve. The staff then comes in and removes those invasive species, like the wild parsnip, and monitors for the endangered ones, like the salamanders. Corey Gritzmacher is the director of operations at the nature preserve. He says Tilly is far better at it than even the highest trained human professionals. Canines can be up to 40 times more efficient than people.
Sometimes the best trained volunteers or staff in the world won't even be able to find what, you know, a canine can. So That's the pretty impressive part about it. And who doesn't want to go to work with a dog?
Just who's in charge is up for debate.
I often joke, you know, it's not necessarily us getting trained. It's kind of them training us. You know, like, this is what you have to do if you want me to do something for you. Right? Yeah. Yes. You always have a lot to say.
Tilia is highly motivated by food or by toys. Gritzmacher says being motivated is the key to being a good conservation dog.
Dogs in general already have 200 million olfactory sensors. We have about 5 million. So they're already set up and designed for scent detection. It's really just finding a dog that's motivated and wants to do it on a regular basis and is excited to do it, right?
4 years old now, Tilia began training as a puppy. It was slow at the start, with treats hidden in cardboard boxes. Then it got progressively more challenging until she graduated to what Gritzmacher calls pairing. That's when he places scent samples in a salt shaker. They're much more appealing with a treat sitting on top.
Eventually we'd start taking the treat away, and then if she continues to hit on the correct sample, then she gets rewarded. So she's gonna get paid again. You know, it's kind of the same thing, you know, we do our work, we get paid. She does her work, she gets paid.
The day I visited, Tilia's excitement was clear. With her vest on, she knew what was happening. Gritzmacher had hidden treats to mimic a search on the prairie for parsnip or salamanders.
She's got a release word. That's kind of her cue to go, we're gonna go search and find something. So, and you're pretty excited to do this today, aren't you? So you gotta go back down to sit. Good girl. All right, Twinkie. It's kind of a little bit of a mind game and an obstacle course for her to work through.
While Tilia's nose is the star, when it comes down to it, the success of the endeavor is as much about the rapport and relationship between the dog and the trainer. If Gritzmacher hadn't trained Tilia, he wouldn't be able to pick up on her subtle body cues, like if she gets distracted by a deer or rabbit and veers off course.
And this is the part where you start training me, right? Yeah, yeah.
Using dogs for conservation work is the same idea as police or search and rescue dogs. While Tilia was the only conservation dog in the state for several years, she now has company, and Gritzmacher only expects that number to grow.
Canines are going to start to play a huge role in the conservation field just because of their amazing detection skills, especially when resources are limited, staff is limited, and you have to search, you know, potentially thousands of acres or miles of shoreline or whatever.
It's tough work for her. Gritzmacher says she gets worn out from a long day at work just like we do. Tilia's owner is the director of the Mequon Nature Preserve. At the end of the day, she gets to go home, be the family dog, and take some well-deserved time off.
Do you agree? Okay, good.
WPR's Mary Kate McCoy brought us that story on Tilia, the conservation dog. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we'll learn about the craft that goes into writing short stories from the Wisconsin author of a new collection. That's coming up next on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You never know where you're going to start and where you're going to end up when you read a collection of short stories. Things don't have to resolve perfectly. Unexpected twists could be around any corner. Sometimes the story just ends on that twist. Our next guest has a new collection of stories out. Sandy Cruz was born and raised in Chippewa Falls, got an English degree from UW-Madison, had a stop at The Onion, has been living in the town of Primrose for the last two decades. Her new book of short stories as S.K. Cruz is called Tales from the Liminal. Sandy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
Well, I hit the dictionary and reminded myself of liminal. It's a between space or a between state, and that really fits your stories well. What is it that draws you to those spaces that don't kind of fit either category?
I am fascinated with liminal spaces because I feel that that is where all of our transformation happens. Those dark and confusing times in our lives where what we believed or what we've been doing has stopped working, but we can't quite yet see the way forward. Nothing new has taken hold yet. And they're terrifying usually at the onset, but in retrospect, they're usually revealed to have been essential to some significant period of growth and change in our life. And it just fascinates me.
Before we take a peek at a story or two, can you tell us about your path to getting into writing and releasing this collection?
Well, it's a long path. I started writing when I was very young. I loved literature. I loved writing. I wrote a ton throughout school. I had my first story published in The Onion back in the day when it was still in Madison. And then I had a lot of kids, and like a lot of people, sometimes you can't get to some of those things you really want to do for a while because of work, you know, family, health, whatever. But in the last seven, eight years, I've had more time for it. And so I wrote two novels, and then I wrote this collection of short stories during the pandemic. And now it's out there in the world.
And you know, the pandemic was kind of, is kind of like this liminal time zone. It feels like in some ways,
yeah,
regular life is on hold. Was that on your brain as you're writing these?
Not consciously, but I actually, the way I wrote these stories, I was trying to put myself in that sort of liminal space between the conscious and unconscious mind, you know, to tap into the flow state. And, you know, I think that is really interesting. I never thought about that. The pandemic was totally a liminal time. And that's kind of how we approached it as a family. You know, a lot of the kids were home from school, some of the kids were home from college, and we try to look at it as an opportunity. You know, it wasn't what any of us expected, not necessarily what any of us wanted, but here it was, and what we were going to do with it. What were we going to do with it, each of us? And I wanted to write short stories, and I'm very happy in retrospect that I had the time to do that.
Talking to Wisconsin author Sandy Cruz about her new short story collection, Tales from the Liminal. Now, I'll admit, you kind of you're in a sweet spot that I like, where there's some supernatural elements, fantastical elements, but it's not like fantasy or horror or science fiction. Can you talk about like how you, kind of deploy that supernatural element in these stories of real people?
Yes, it's, you know, when I sat down to write these stories, that is what came out of me. And so maybe I'm just a little strange. I don't know. It's my voice. I do know, like, the literature that always really excited me. Like the first story that really caught my attention as a young person, I was in sixth grade, I read Something Wicked This Way Comes by Ray Bradbury. And I thought that was pretty amazing. But in eighth grade, I can remember exactly where I was sitting at my desk. I can remember the light in the room, the feel of the glossy paper, the image on the cover of the magazine where I read for the first time Kafka's The Metamorphosis. I couldn't believe what I had read. I had never encountered anything like that before. It just revolutionized for me what you could do with writing. And I've always been attracted to that type of literature. So I guess when I sit down to write and I tap into, you know, the unconscious, I suppose it's not that surprising that that's what comes out of me, because that's what I've always loved. I've spent a lot of time reading those sort of strange existential texts that just do strange things.
That reminds me of one of your stories, that a man posts picture of unusual rock, then gets call from concerned parties. It was a little Kafka-y in some ways. Could you share what went into that story a little bit?
Well, I just was so humored by, you know, those clickbait articles that come up where, you know, there's a picture and it says man posts picture of his wife and gets call from police, and you're looking at the photo trying to see what did they see in the picture, you know. And these kept coming up in my newsfeed, and I thought, I have to write a ridiculous story about this. So that was the premise of that one.
And it ends up getting into a little, there's some kind of a supernatural agency or something, and
yes,
maybe a ghost. I don't want to spoil it.
Yes, it's a comedic turn of the screw-esque type story. And poor Mr. McGafferty, you know, is just kind of happily but obliviously living his life, and this dark underworld that he believes he's being drawn into ends up, you know, making him a little less thoughtlessly engaged with his life. But sort of at the heart, the sort of big question at the heart of the story is Socrates' adage, the unexamined life is not worth living. And, you know, as a person who has spent a lot of their life really examining everything, sometimes I wonder, you know, what's so wrong with just being obliviously happy? So that's kind of the question in that story. And I love that story.
Hang on. Yeah. Your character said that was a Vince Lombardi quote.
I know, because he's a little clueless about most things. But, you know, Vince Lombardi said some great things, right?
Yeah. And that reminds me of something else I want to ask you about. That story and a lot of other ones don't explicitly take place in Wisconsin, but I could see a lot of them taking place in Wisconsin, right?
Oh my gosh, yes. You know, when you were sharing some of the questions you might be asking me, I looked through my stories and 12 of the 15 stories take place in small towns because it's my whole mental schema for life and interactions between people. And so many of the interactions, because they're very intimate interactions between two people, just that container of a small town makes that possible in a way. You know, I live out in rural Wisconsin now where we're somewhat isolated, and, you know, I've spent time in big cities and there's a lot of anonymity there, but small towns have this character to them where, you know, people know you, people know what your family's been through, what your history is. And it makes these interactions possible.
Short stories here. You've done a couple novels, as you mentioned, you've tasted them both. What's next?
I'm going to start working on another novel next, and I got an agent this summer, so that's exciting. Mm-hmm. And she's trying to sell my sci-fi drama. So I think probably a novel will be next, but I definitely would like to write some more short stories. I love short stories. I think it might be my favorite medium.
And just a quick thought, if somebody's out there thinking, I used to like to write, and I always intended to be a writer, a quick bit of inspiration for him to maybe pick up the pen?
I would say, don't give up. Don't give up. As a person who waited a long time to get to this point, I'm 51 now. Don't give up. And work hard, do whatever you can to get better at your craft.
Sandy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Rob, for having me.
That's Sandy Cruz, Wisconsin-based author. We talked to her about her new collection of short stories as S.K. Cruz. It's called Tales from the Liminal. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a lot of money has gone into cryptocurrencies. But what are they? How do they work? We'll get the latest on Bitcoin, the most famous one, and a lot of the other alternative monies out there. And you can join in with your experiences and questions. You can actually let us know if you've tried investing in them right now over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And as many Americans get their third COVID vaccine shots, a lot of countries are waiting for their first round. A health expert shares the latest in the effort to get the vaccine to more low-income countries and why there's a lot at stake there for us here in the United States. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we take a look at what it would take to phase out or significantly decrease the use of the world's number one energy source, coal. First, the U.S. House is voting today to strip a Republican member of Congress from his committee assignments after tweeting an edited cartoon video depicting violence against a Democratic colleague. And some Republicans in Congress are stepping up pressure to punish fellow Republicans who supported President Joe Biden's bipartisan infrastructure plan. It's the week in Washington. We'll talk about those stories and more, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see members of different parties work together, compromise on legislation like the bipartisan infrastructure deal? Are you willing to accept a bill that's made compromises to win over another party? Do you worry about divisive or violent political rhetoric? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Lisa Mascaro is Chief Congressional Correspondent for the AP. Lisa, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Can you talk us through this tweet from Representative Paul Gosar's office that got all this pushback that's leading to this vote this afternoon?
Yes, exactly. That vote is going away right now as we're speaking. It's been a really tense afternoon here in Congress as the House is preparing to take this vote. It was sort of a sudden but deliberate action by the Democratic leadership to really step forward and move to censure the Republican congressman, which is really a rare sort of, we haven't seen a censure of a lawmaker for, more than a decade since Democrat Charlie Rangel was censured back in 2010. So this is not a step that is taken lightly. The vote is happening right now as we speak, and it is almost certain to go along party lines, just a very few number of Republicans stepping over to join Democrats in condemning what this congressman did. So the tweet was a video clip of what's called this, anime, sort of animated, action shot of of a basically sword fight, and the congressman imposed, you know, his face on one of the characters, and the face of the congresswoman, the Democratic congresswoman from New York, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, on the other. And, you know, it's a somewhat graphic, you know, depiction of basically a flaying, right, a stabbing. And, you know, a lot of folks were sort of, Republicans were sort of brushing it off. This is just, you know, a sort of cartoon. It's this, you know, form of animation called anime. And just sort of brushing it off as a cartoon, you know, kind of exaggeration. Democrats said, no, you know, we're in a different era now. I mean, we saw the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol, the deadly insurrection, right, that left a lot of damage and people died in the course of the day in the aftermath. And, you know, we have seen an escalating sense of rhetoric and attacks threatened on lawmakers. The Associated Press earlier this year, one of my colleagues had an interview with the head of the Capitol Police that said, you know, they're getting thousands of threats on lawmakers. Lawmakers have taken to beefing up their security when they travel to and from Washington. You know, beefed up the security at their homes. We are in this very sort of tense political climate as a nation. And so the Democratic leaders of the House said this cannot stand and there needs to be some accountability here. The Democratic leaders called on the Republican leadership to take action against this congressman. The Republican leadership did not. And so the Democratic leadership, Speaker Pelosi and her team stepped up and put this resolution forward fairly quickly this week. It does two things. It would censure the congressman, which is this formal rebuke, and then would also strip him of the committee assignments where he serves. And one of the committees he serves on is with the congresswoman from New York, AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. So it's really a serious message. He has, you know, defended himself, and he had in this very long debate on the floor just now, a number of Republicans, really all the Republicans that were speaking were pretty much all speaking in his defense and in saying that the Democrats were making just, you know, too much of this, and that it was, you know, unfair treatment, sort of making him out to be a bit of a victim of circumstance here.
I want to give a listen. I want to give a listen, Lisa, to a couple of voices on the House floor today.
Yeah.
First of all, the person targeted in this video, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, talking on the House floor ahead of this vote today.
What is so hard? What is so hard about saying that this is wrong? This is not about me. This is not about Representative Gosar. But this is about what we are willing to accept.
Then here's House Minority Leader Republican Kevin McCarthy talking about the vote today.
For Democrats, this vote isn't about a video. It's about control. That's the one and only thing Democrats are interested in. Not condemning violence, not protecting the institution, not decorum or decency, just control.
Does that sum up the argument from both sides, really talking past each other, it sounds like, Lisa?
Yeah, that is right. You know, Democrats, again, saying this cannot stand, and Republicans saying, you know, it's not really about this. That, you know, a lot of the Republican grievance comes with some of the other rules that have been put in place, you know, because of COVID, you know, wearing masks on the floor, getting fined if you don't wear masks. Which a lot of the Republicans don't agree with, and also just the continued sort of prosecution that's happening because of the insurrection on January 6th. You know, the Republicans are not participating, mostly not the Republican leadership not participating in the committee that Pelosi stood up to investigate, you know, what happened on January 6th, of course. Two very prominent members, Republicans, Congresswoman Liz Cheney and Congressman Adam Kinzinger, are participating, but, you know, the Republican leadership is not. And so that sort of, you know, again, feeds into this complaint that they have over sort of the treatment. And as you say, just really heightens the divisions in this country. At one point during the floor debate, Steny Hoyer, who is the majority leader from Maryland, served in Congress a very long time. And, you know, he just turned to his Republican colleagues and said, you know, do you have no shame? And I couldn't help but hear the echoes of the, you know, the McCarthy hearings. You know, there was that sort of famous line similar during the McCarthy hearings of Joseph McCarthy in the last century when Congress was sort of, you know, so divided. Of course, that became a turning point, which I don't know that this will be a turning point at all.
Talking to Lisa Mascaro from AP, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. You can join in with your reaction to that vote going on today in the House to censure a Republican congressman for his office releasing this edited video showing him, in effect, stabbing Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in cartoon form. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Lisa, also going on now, reaction to the infrastructure vote of Republicans encouraging punishment of fellow Republicans who voted in favor of the what's been called the bipartisan infrastructure plan. Got some Republican votes in the Senate. What's going on now?
Yeah, it's really, again, a sort of striking turn of events here. I mean, infrastructure of all the issues in Congress used to be one of the longstanding bipartisan issues. You know, everyone needs federal help in supporting their local community's ability to build roads and bridges and upgrade water systems and increasingly now broadband and, you know, electrical infrastructure. And of course, this bill passed by the Senate earlier this year and then went over to the House. A number of House Republicans joined in. President Biden had a big celebration Monday at the White House. Hundreds of lawmakers came. They signed it into law. But, you know, these Republicans are just getting in so much, facing so much backlash for having joined in this vote. The former president, Donald Trump, has been attacking them. He's been attacking Republican leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, for sort of allowing it to come to fruition in the Senate. You know, it's just for those who've been dealing with these issues for a number of years, you know, decades in Congress or, you know, the different groups, the county associations, state associations. I mean, this is just really I don't want to overstate it, but I do want to point out it's just an unusual turn of events to have people facing such backlash for having supported something that is typically, you know, so needed in so many communities. I mean, gosh, everyone sees these reports, you know, from the engineering associations about, you know, bridges that are in need of repair, or we've seen bridges fall down in communities, you know, roads, everyone, I'm sure, can attest in your state there and here, you know, in Washington, elsewhere, of, you know, roads that need repair. And yet it's just shows how partisan things have become, that even this sort of federal spending on what used to be considered sort of, you know, basics for communities, you know, is facing such a backlash to the point that some of these lawmakers, one of my colleagues did a story, these lawmakers are getting phone calls to their offices, you know, some of them even having to go to the authorities to report them as, you know, as violent threats, you know, against them for this vote. So it's a very difficult environment for these lawmakers to be working and, you know, for the country to be sort of having this kind of sentiment.
We're talking to Lisa Mascaro, Chief Congressional Correspondent for the AP, with us today for our weekly roundup of some of the top stories in Washington. You can join in at 800-642-1234. The Biden administration this week celebrating the bipartisan infrastructure deal becoming law. Are you celebrating? Were you glad to see something pass after years of talk about it? If you're a Republican, what do you think of some Republicans who joined in and voted for this plan? A good number of them in the Senate, some in the House as well in the latest vote. What do you want to see make it into the Democrats' other spending package, the social safety net and climate change bill? Do you want to see that passed? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our look at some of the top stories in national politics. Lisa Mascaro with the AP stays with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you glad to see the new infrastructure bill signed into law on Monday? What, if anything, are you hoping comes out of it? Maybe even here in Wisconsin when it comes to roads and bridges, highways, broadband expansion. Is that a problem in your neck of the woods? 800-642-1234 is the number with your reactions or questions. That's 800-642-1234. Lisa, as I mentioned, the president, as you mentioned earlier, the president signed this thing, the infrastructure bill, into law on Monday. Now in a kind of a victory lap, a rickety bridge, I think, in New Hampshire. This afternoon, he's in Detroit at electric vehicle testing plant. What are we seeing now from the administration when it comes to selling what they're saying are the benefits of this bill?
Yes, you're absolutely right. There is just a sort of storming of the country, right? A full effort by the administration. And also we're going to see more apparently from the lawmakers. They were sort of saying this week that they would be out doing events between now and Christmas, you know, 1,000 events, because they want lawmakers, the lawmakers want the public to understand, you know, what's in this bill. There's been a lot of reporting over the last month. We've written a lot of others as well about, you know, the churn of trying to get these bills, you know, through Congress. And now they're trying to, the president and the party are trying to help people understand what's in them. And so we're going to see a lot more of that. I know the administration has made plans to send folks out to the states. There's a list, you know, a long list of folks heading out to the states over the next few days, and lawmakers as well. They want to be talking about this bill, the bipartisan infrastructure bill, which is sort of what we call the hard infrastructure, the stuff you mentioned, the roads, bridges, broadband, water pipes. And then turning toward the bill that hasn't passed yet, but that is sort of inching its way, this broader, you know, Biden package of the of the social service and climate change. And I'll say, look, you know, the midterm election is right around the corner next year, and the polling doesn't look great for the president and his party. They've got sluggish numbers right now, and so, you know, they've got a very narrow hold on Congress, and the president's party tends to not do well in the midterm elections of the first year, you know, first term president. So kind of all the signs are against the Democrats having a, you know, that they would have a tough year in next year's election. The chance that the, you know, Congress could flip to Republican control is very real. And so they want to, you know, put their best foot forward and try to go out and sell this stuff and make the case that, you know, the Republicans didn't really help well, they helped a little bit on the infrastructure stuff, but, you know, not so much on this next package. And of course, the Republicans will be out, you know, working against it as well. So we're about to sort of see the early signs of the sort of campaigns taking shape here.
Looking at that next package, you mentioned the social spending and climate change and other stuff. The numbers have come down a lot over the course of this year on what Democrats are shooting for. What is the latest? What are we looking at for timelines on voting on something here?
Yes. Well, as soon as the House gets done here today, I imagine tomorrow or Friday, we're going to start seeing the floor debate pick up again. The Democratic leaders have indicated they hope to vote that package through the House by the end of the week here before they all head home for the Thanksgiving holiday next week. So whether that is Friday, I think we're kind of looking at a Friday vote. There's been talk of Thursday, Friday, Saturday. So we'll see what they do. Right now, the situation, you know, this has been a long back and forth between the progressive and the centrist members of Congress to kind of get this package to a level that everyone can live with and stand behind. You know, they're not getting in, Democrats are not getting any support from Republicans for this, so they have to do it all on their own. They just have a few votes to spare in their majority in the House and zero margin for error in the Senate, because the Senate, of course, is evenly split right now, 50-50. So with the vice president, you know, they get, the Democrats get the majority, Biden's party gets the majority. So they just, they need everybody on board. And that's caused this, you know, big back and forth between the centrists and the progressives. But they're almost there. As you mentioned, they've scaled the bill way back. It's about half the size it once was proposed at. You started at 3.5 trillion. It's now down to about 1.85 trillion, which is still an enormous public federal investment. And this is, gosh, a wide range of services, you know, funding to lower the cost of childcare for families by helping families with subsidies to pay childcare. There's subsidies to help people pay their, if they're buying their own health insurance out there. There's money to invest in climate change programs, more infrastructure programs. So it's just quite a lot in this package. And folks probably have been hearing about it. So we'll see if the House can get it over the finish line by the end of the week. They're waiting for some final tallies to come in from the Congressional Budget Office to sort of ensure that the spending will be paid for. The most of the revenue is coming from some of the new taxes on the wealthier folks, the surtax on the wealthy, the savings coming from lowering the cost to the government for pharmaceutical drugs on Medicare. So they just want to make sure, the centrist lawmakers just really want to make sure that this isn't going to be adding to the deficit. It's all going to be paid for. Once those final numbers come in, budget office says they should be in by the end of the week. It looks like the House is going to be pretty ready to go. Senate is going to be a little slower. They're saying by Christmas in the Senate. So we'll see if they can get it there or not.
And then just in our last couple of minutes, Lisa, I want to take a look at something you wrote about. You mentioned the child care assistance. Briefly, this has been a long effort going back as far as World War II.
Yes, goodness. It has been some 80 years. And a lot of the lawmakers in the House, especially a lot of the women lawmakers that have been fighting for this for decades, and some men like to point that out, that, you know, there was this brief experiment in federally funded child care back in World War II to help women when women were going to work in the factories for the war effort. And then, of course, Congress had passed a bill in the Nixon era that provided that federal help for child care. And Nixon famously vetoed it, you know, back in the day, because Republicans had called it sort of, you know, a sort of form of socialism and sort of, you know, federal reach into child raising. And so, you know, now the argument is that, look, you know, women have left the workforce in droves during the pandemic to stay home and care for kids. And if you want to get the economy back to working order, you know, women and families need help. And I'm sure your listeners know, you know, childcare can be extremely expensive. And so this would cap the amount that families pay for childcare, 7% of your income, no more of 7% of your income. You know, that's the plan. And they were trying to get that out. So we'll see. It would be a historic first for the country and put the country on par with other developed nations that do offer this kind of support for families with kids.
And Lisa, very briefly, this is an item that may or may not survive the cut, assuming the whole thing even gets passed, right?
Yeah, the child care is potentially more stable in the package, but the effort to provide paid family leave, so if your employer does not allow you time off to care for kids or loved ones, there would be a federal program that allows that. So for people maybe who work at companies that don't provide that kind of benefit, or in states that offer that kind of benefit, there would be a federal program. And that's what does face opposition over in the Senate. So we'll see if that's going to be something that can stay in the bill or gets taken out in the final revisions.
Lisa, thanks for bringing us up to date today.
You bet, Rob. Thanks for having me.
That was Lisa Mascaro, Chief Congressional Correspondent for the AP, with us today for our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. Coming up after the news, we'll take a look at how the UN Climate Summit attempts to decrease coal usage as part of climate change efforts, and whether it's possible to reach the goals that came out of that summit. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.